is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Syria. The failed state of Syria. Darkness visible. We're joined by Malcolm Hohnlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations, to take us to Syria, the aftermath of a raid, a successful raid by the IAF. And the question is asked, why didn't Russia answer by using its fabled S-300 system against the IAF? Malcolm, this is a puzzle. The Assad regime is said to be victorious, but they're no longer defending their territory with their Russian colleagues. Why not? Good evening to you.
Good evening to both of you. And it's a very interesting and complex story, as you know, these Syrian raids that took place with a number of post-raid developments. And as the assessment of the damage caused by the last raid, which supposedly destroyed 1,000 Iranian ship missiles stored in this location, which was guarded by Iran Revolutionary Guard and others, Hezbollah, in MYSAF, M-A-Y-S-A-F, so the destruction was very critical. I mean, it really dealt a serious blow, and there were no anti-aircraft fired, and it's because Russia took out an S-300 unit that they had located there and had been there for quite a while and moved it to Ukraine. So there were 24 units that had originally been sent. We don't know how many others have been returned to Ukraine, but this one in particular was. So they moved the S-300s around and left this place unprotected. Also, Syria has since asked the Arab countries and the Hezbollah and the terrorist organizations not to attack Israel from its territory, saying that they are still in the process of rebuilding and they have all the problems. The military experts from Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Hezbollah, and the Al-Quds force of the IRGC participated in a meeting in Syria, and Assad made this appeal to them that they should attack other strikes. And they're saying that's one of the reasons that Iran is attacking United States bases, as we saw with the attack on the Al-Tanf base, where U.S. troops were located, and that the attacks have been more sophisticated, but more limited. And I think that the message is very clear, that Syria doesn't want to have the wrath of Israel come down on it for allowing these attacks to take place from their soil.
Malcolm, Iran continues to move weapons, systems, correction, men, and material into Syria. Why does Assad permit that?
Because they have to. He has to. He has no say. He has no ability to stop them. He doesn't want a confrontation between Iranian militias, which are often Afghani or Iraqi or others, not Iranian soldiers. Also, you have Hezbollah, which is totally allied with Iran against Syria. So any attempt by them to, by Syria, to block the shipments that Iran are sending in, even though it means that retaliation is inevitable, the weapons are needed in Syria by the militias and by Hezbollah in Lebanon and in Syria. So for them, it's a lifeline, and they are not going to allow Assad to interfere with it.
Nasrallah is making more threats. Anything new in this? This is the general secretary of the Hezbollah terror organization working for Iran. Why is he threatening anew, Malcolm?
Well, I do think that there is an escalation in the threats. And they as I told you, they met with that meeting that I just mentioned. But also, he met first with Islamic Jihad leaders, talking about the next stage of anti-Israel action after the Islamic Jihad attacks against Israel and the war, the conflict of recent days. But he met immediately thereafter also with Hamas leadership and trying to coordinate between them. We see his language is escalating and saying that he sent drones and other things against the Israeli, the Karish field, where Israel is preparing to do exploration, a gas field. And at the same time, they are negotiating with Lebanon about border disputes in the Mediterranean Sea that both sides claim. There's been a lot of progress, we're told, in those talks, but they're not resolved. And because Hezbollah is threatening that they will escalate the war, there's a lot of fear that this is going to be a new flare-up, and it may not be so controllable once it's launched. So there's a lot of concern, even by Israeli officials, about coordination in the approaches, Hamas, Hezbollah, the other terrorist entities, and against Israel, and the likelihood, the possibility that they will export this, which is something that that Nasrallah warned about also, saying we're going to do this in the West Bank, the same thing we did in Gaza, building up the terrorist organizations. We can do the same thing in the West Bank, and the reports of increased activity in the West Bank, but also saying they would attack any Arab country that dares to cooperate with Israel. So they want to say that there's no safe place for Israel and citizens. They'll attack from the West Bank. They can attack from Lebanon, from Syria, from Gaza, even from Iraq. And this is something that's being taken quite seriously.
That is?
Malcolm, there's been talking, they're talking in Vienna about resurrecting the deal with the living dead. Now, there's been talk as well that this version of the Iran nuclear pact is somehow worse than the original. What can you tell us?
It's worse in many ways. And I think that the visits by the head of the Mossad, the head of the Israel Defense Force, the Minister of Defense, and others to the National Security Council, to Washington, to make a case. And Lapid, the prime minister, claims that some of the points they made have been accepted. But when the American people find out all the details of what's entailed in this, how much Iran will get, $100 billion in the first years, $1 trillion over the first decade. You know that money is going into supporting terrorism against the United States, against our allies, against our partners in the Gulf. It's much shorter and it's weaker. In 2 years, they could be outside of a lot of the sanctions. And in this case, as opposed to the last one, there's no snapback provisions. No individual country can withdraw. That it has to be a collective decision. As we know, the Europeans are not exactly heroes when it comes to taking strong stands. And Russia is playing a major role, both in implementing and guaranteeing the agreement. And certainly we know President Putin will benefit. But the question is financially, militarily, strategically, which benefits will he derive? And that question of what happens with the International Atomic Energy Agency probe into Iran, as you know, that there were these remnants of nuclear materials found. Iran refuses to explain it, refuses to give access to the IAEA inspectors. And this could be the breaking issue, because even today, the IAEA said they will not stop their probe. And Iran said no deal if they don't stop it. And as I said, a lot more money is involved. But more than that, if one looks at the details of what is expected in this deal, it's a matter of great concern. Even if the president signs it, the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act requires him to bring it before Congress. But Congress only has 30 days to review the deal. There was a 60-day extension in 2015, but for recess. And that does not apply now. So they're looking if that could be done and if they can strengthen this legislation. The problem is that there won't be 67 votes to veto it. You need 17 Democrats to join the Republicans in Congress to do that. Right now, the general assessment is while there are Democrats who will go against it, that we won't be able to see the majority that we're talking about. So there is a lot going on. There's a lot of moving parts right now. The Israelis argue that the United States has to show and demonstrate that there is a viable military option, not exercise it, but show that they are really serious, that if there are violations, that there will be consequences for it. Iran is engaging in all of these provocative actions, not only their statements, but through their allies, but by their own actions. We know that they have 93 million barrels of oil offshore in the Gulf, in Singapore, even in Venezuela, off the coast of China, as well as some offshore tanks of their own, storage tanks, and that they would be able to release this as well. So you're talking about huge sums of money coming to Iran with very few restrictions remaining in place. And it is not true that they can bind future presidents. That's not legal. But we know that they're continuing supporting Houthis and all of these others who will gain from it. and that the Cascades and the Four, though, will just be put on hold. Nothing's going to be destroyed. So they can restart all of this immediately and get to enrichment at weapons level.
Malcolm, can I just ask this? I just want to be clear on this point. In the deal, there's no prohibition on Iran from engaging in terrorism, and that the deal will go away if they do.
100% right. And it's one of the several points that are completely absent. No limit on this, on the satellite launches. And they're talking now about launching their own satellites, homemade rockets, et cetera, and an expanding program. Over the next 4 years, they're expanding their drones, they're expanding their sea capabilities and their terrorist activities. And there's no addressing any of these aggressive actions. So when you look at the skepticism of our allies, you can get a real understanding why they are so concerned and what is at stake in this beyond just, it's not a piece of paper. This is not allies coming together signing an agreement for future progress. This is the leading terrorist country in the world demonstrating that they're continuing it, continuing all aspects of their nuclear program. And all we're doing is delaying it, perhaps, but not for long.
I read from Al Monitor in these last days about activities in Iran. The Army of the Islamic Republic of Iran wrapped up a two-day nationwide drill in which as many as 150 drones were tested in combat, reconnaissance, and electronic warfare. The exercise was held in multiple land locations, as well as in the Persian Gulf waters and the Sea of Oman. According to the drill's spokesperson, the drones successfully struck mock enemy positions using precision missiles and other weapons. Malcolm, who's this meant to intimidate? Everybody, all of the above, or Israel?
Well, it's meant for Israel and, more importantly, for their Gulf allies, because these drones can hit Saudi Arabia as they have, UAE as they have, Yemen as they have, but also for other regional parties. And one of the reasons they do this is because they don't have an air force. So the drones really take the place of the absent air force. And they are exercising and the missile capacity as well, which is matched to it. So it's meant to intimidate. It's meant to say that they can exercise it. But the fact is that their military capacity as it is today is limited. But the infusion of hundreds of millions of billions of dollars over the years will enable them to expand it. And if we remove some of the sanctions, like on aircraft parts and things like that, they will be able to rebuild both their air force and their domestic capacity in other regards. So with a limited period for the sanctions to remain, the ballistic missile sanction runs out at the end of next year anyway. And I think that this is, in every respect, a very dangerous deal. And the level of concern that we hear is more than justified.
Thaddeus?
Malcolm, the market is heating up at the very time the market for ice cream is not going to be cut. What's happened?
Yeah, well, we don't want to mix the products, but you're absolutely right. The good news for today was that Israel's natural gas production was up by 22% in the first half of the year, and they're ramping up exports to try to get more to Europe to make up for the shortages that Europe is experiencing. So the production rose to almost 11 billion cubic meters through June from both Tamar and Leviathan fields, which makes the one that we mentioned before near the border with Lebanon all the more important because they need the additional production. And exports were about 42% of the total. So the gas is first sent to Egypt, where they have an LNG capacity, and then exported to the EU. And the royalties, I think, were up about 48% as well. So this was very good news in a difficult economic year. Ben and Jerry's, which I know is your favorite, John. Ben and Jerry's tried to block a plan by its corporate parent, Unilever Company, to allow it to sell its products in East Jerusalem and the West Bank, where they pulled out. Ben and Jerry's pulled out of it. This was a BDS move on their part, and the court ruled that the products should be sold and displaying Hebrew and new Hebrew and Arabic language trademarks. And this is a real put down for the Ben & Jerry's company and a victory for those who are against the boycotts and its illegal maneuvers.
Malcolm Hohnlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations, Thaddeus McCotter, American Greatness. The Dusty One is due up next. I'm John Batchelor.